You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream. Dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and follow my face on somebody's new mowed lawn.
You know this one. It's Daydream by The Lovin' Spoonful, a song written and sung by my guest this week, John Sebastian. John Sebastian is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with his band, The Lovin' Spoonful. He's recorded many solo albums, and he's the author of several children's books. His songs have been the soundtrack of our lives. Do You Believe in Magic, Darling Be Home Soon, Summer in the City, Welcome Back, to name a few. John Sebastian, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much.
Gosh, I know you've probably talked about it a million times, but I have to ask you about your iconic performance at the Woodstock Music Festival in 1969. Do you have a vivid memory of the event?
Of course I do. Yeah. And, there's a kind of an anxiousness in the American audience to have this be this moment that I can barely cope with. It's so astonishing. But the fact is, I had been doing concerts, one guy, one guitar, for the whole time since the Lovin' Spoonful had broken up. So it's kind of what I did for a living already. So this gathering, the surprise was, this was a surprisingly intimate audience. And that's a hard thing for folks who weren't there to get it. But this is a thing that entertainers, musicians, whatever, experience. You learn how to do something, and maybe you learn how to do it with 30 people in a room. But does it change that much when it's you tell you give 500,000. You give your listeners the number, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Is it necessarily any different? And my feeling was that it wasn't.
Well, is that because you were just talking to the 25 people that were in the front row, or were you talking to the person in the, you know, the 500,000th person back there?
I tell you, I felt like I knew that crowd. That's that simple, and that's what facilitates some kind of intimacy from a stage. I think, it really has to come from somewhere. There's certainly actors and who are very good at creating the impression, but I had the luckiest thing happen to me, which was I had just spent those years before that gig, learning how to shed at that time I was trying to shed the kind of full rock and roll impression that the Spoonful had given, and I was sort of headed into a one guy, one guitar kind of a life.
Well, now it's interesting that you talk about that guitar, because in the Spoonful, you famously played the auto harp, and I don't think anybody in any rock band ever in history played the auto harp.
Well, within a year or two, actually, several folks started taking it up, but I was lucky in that I, in desperation to be as loud as Zolly, had plugged a ukulele contact mic, which I had carefully taped onto the back of the auto harp, into a huge amplifier, and came up with much more fun.
Did you have to spend every waking hour between gigs tuning the auto harp?
You're close, pal. You are very close. No, and in fact, Yanofsky, he used to run interference for me because he knew that, although he made jokes about it all the time, he knew that it was genuinely stressful for me. And yes, that was a major concern. And remember, I'm still learning some of the technical things about tuning. I had listened to piano tuners really frequently because there was one in our house when I was, you know, a little kid. These auto harps command a particular type of, tuners call it sweet tuning, and it means where your major third and your seventh note are quite flat. So it's great for when you play in the key that you've planned to play in. But if somebody says, hey, let's do this in B-flat, you know, all of a sudden your instrument sounds really out of tune.
And the auto harp, it's got a beautiful sound when in tune and just a horrendous sound almost all over.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, how did you hit on the auto harp? Was like you were kind of, you know, bringing folk music into rock music? Or
I really didn't approach it that way, but the sequence was that I was going to a summer camp the year or so before, maybe two years before, and in that experience, I had two sisters that I was very attracted to, and they both played the auto harp. And specifically, they could Carter pick, which is it's a specific kind of a guitar discipline, right? Just a strumming thing. And so it took about half the summer, but by halfway through the summer, I had been accepted by the beautiful sisters who were all, you know, they were like pals with Joni, and they lived in Cambridge, and oh, they were all up in the folk music thing, you know?
So it was those two girls that got you into the auto harp.
Yes.
It's always girls that are behind.
Always girls. Absolutely.
Do you still play your auto harp from time to time?
Oh yeah. As a matter of fact, it got very specifically more interesting as people began to call me for sessions, and especially people who would call for sessions who didn't know about these things about the auto harp. At one point, I got a call from Dolly Parton's producer, and he says, you know, Dolly wants you to come in and cut Just When I Needed You Most, which had been a tune I had recorded previously with a guy named Randy Van Wormer. And so I said, yeah, I'd love to do it. He said, great, she wants it in E-flat. Well, you know, just a little look at an auto harp can tell you there isn't really... That's hardly on there. So
did you have to retune the whole thing, or what do you do?
Oh, I do a lot of retuning, but this required more. I went to an auto harp builder friend of mine, and I said, how about an E-flat auto harp? He said, oh, yeah, well, we could do that. Well, it's going to take me some time. I said, you know, if you can finish this in 3 weeks, it will spend its fourth week crushed against Dolly's breast. And there was a pause, and the guy said, I'll have it to you. And he did.
Had you met Dolly Parton previous to that?
I had not met Dolly, no. But wow, what a charming woman! What a genius! Pure and simple. That's the genius that I've met in my life.
I saw her in in Tahoe in 1981. And man, she was so entertaining and fabulous. And that was before she was, you know, the huge megastar that she became.
Right.
She was great. So funny. She's got a great sense of humor.
Oh, so self-deprecating. Oh, my God. Yeah, she disarms you in 2 minutes.
What about the record company when you came in with your auto harp? Did they say, wait a minute, John, Paul, George, and Ringo, they don't play auto harps, and that's what we're looking for? Or did they say, oh, cool?
I was very lucky in that I sort of had a team by the time that I had begun to play the auto harp, and people like Eric Jacobson and Bob Cavallo, they were the first guys to go, you guys just wait. Make fun of the auto harp. Come on, let's hear it. We want you on tape when we show you the number one single.
Well, that you did do an... You did an album at Elektra where you have like four tracks on the record, that What's Shaken album, I think it's called.
Yes.
But then you're not on Elektra. You're on Kama Sutra, was it?
That's right. What a huge mistake on our part. What ignorance. But I'll tell you how it happened.
Please do.
Spoonful really did feel like we were taking a step. We didn't know quite what it was, but we knew that we didn't fit in with the... I'd done sessions for Judy Collins, but I was never going to be a guy for her audience, for example. But I had this kind of young harmonica player slot that I ended up having with the several people, including her. But... when we came to what we wanted to do, the auto harp was a kind of an afterthought. It really came about because I had been looking for a set of chords that I could make the auto harp play if I wanted to. It involved, again, it was retuning. That was a crucial step, and like I say, having like somebody like Eric Jacobson, who had such confidence in both me and Zao. I mean, he really said, "Look, I can't tell you what they're going to do, but it's going to be good," and I think that helped away any fears that record companies might have had.
Yeah, but you were going to tell me how you ended up not with Elektra.
Well, okay, so the steps are, I'm working as an accompanist for Elektra, and we eventually get, I don't know if we got an offer, or we said, well, we can't go with Elektra. That was like a foregone conclusion, because they're like all these folkies. And they won't know what to do with a pop record. That was
now,
our...
What year was it? I mean, it was before the Doors, obviously, right? Cause...
Oh, wait, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was it 65 or 64? Or...
Well, I guess it would be right in there somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, right in there somewhere. So then we get, I believe it was a letter from Jack Holtzman. Now, you have to remember, I had a very different relationship with Jack Holtzman than most people or aspiring musicians, in that I was in his office all the time. This was when he was just hiring Paul Rothchild at that time, who of course would be his most successful producer, and I was helping Paul as a kind of a flunky who he realized that I could remember sequential takes with a lot of these odd singer-songwriters we were recording. Odd in that they were like guys like Timmy Harden and Freddie Neal, like that mercurial, you know, a session could blow up in a second. But when we got to selecting a label, we just figured, no, we can't do it with Elektra. They won't know what to do. And it's a decision I continue to regret, because that would have been, you know, having a real record company that had some life to it and some longevity would have meant the same kind of things that are automatic with groups like the Beach Boys or the Beatles or any of our various English contemporaries.
Well, I guess there's no way of knowing how that label would work out. I mean, they were...
I guess you couldn't know. But that was a firm decision, and it was remarkable how quickly we came to it. Oh, no, we can't do that, because they're this. Well, you know, here comes the horizon, and it's life is going to change. And it did catch us off guard, and really, we... Our series of first, the experience of hanging with the Ghanas, where you really learn how much you have not, how unsuccessful you've really been. It takes a while before you realize it.
In the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Been down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match head. But now it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on, and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer in the city. Summer in the city.
John Sebastian, when the Lovin' Spoonful became a hit rock and roll band, touring and television appearances and all that, were you ready for your success?
I felt completely confident because I had Zal Yanofsky. Yeah, there wasn't any work for any of us to do. Just don't look like an idiot, don't stare at your shoes, and Yanofsky's going to do everything else. And that was the way it was. It was like having our own Tumbler in the band.
How did you two meet?
We met through Cass Elliott. Cass Elliott said, "Oh, I'm gonna introduce you to a guy you're gonna love." I'm okay. He says, "She says, oh, and by the way, come by my house on the Beatles' first appearance on Ed Sullivan." Because Ringo's going to be there. I said, Ringo's going to be at the studio? No, Ringo, he'll be at my house. And I go, and this is the kind of faith that people had in Cass at that time. I went, okay, so the Beatles are appearing, but Ringo's going to be at Cass's house. I said, I can't figure out what this is, but I'm going. So... and sure enough, there's a very tall, Jewish-looking Ringo in her apartment. At that time, Zal's particular hairdo really made it an easy comparison. And we started playing, and we're watching the Beatles on the tube, and we're also sort of playing at the same time and going, hey, that's a cool idea, some of those chords were. And we finish, and then we play for a couple hours, just sitting around laughing with Cass and smoking dope and telling stories. Well, the next day, it was like 16-year-old girls. Cass calls me and says, well, so how did you like that? I said, Cass, that was the most unconventional, odd combination of musical influences I've ever heard. You know, the guy is obviously so able with finger picking and folk music and all of that, but he also wants to be Elmore James. I love this. So I got a conversation that came from her saying, oh, yeah, well, I talked to Zal. Zal said, he thought you were the meanest guitar player he'd ever heard. And so it went back and forth like that, and it was, you know, it was real, very 16-year-old teenage girls for a while, as she kind of made that a more firm link. And it was very shortly thereafter. Remember, at that point, I had stood on a stage. No, I'm sorry. That within a month, I'd be standing on a stage with Sal and Cass and Denny, no, not Denny Daugherty, James Hendricks, not Jimmy. And this group that had been a thing called the Big Three morphed into the Mugwumps. And the Mugwumps were a band that they brought me in.
You were an official mugwump?
I wasn't an official mugwump. No. I was more of an accompanist. There were two the people that fit that category was me and the drummer, a guy named Art Stokes, who was some other famous hard bop drummer's cousin or something, but played absolutely in no style that fit. Let me just see what somebody wants to bother me about.
No problem. While John Sebastian takes his phone call, we'll take a break. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll continue our discussion with John Sebastian right after this. Believe in Magic by the Lovin' Spoonful, and we're chatting with the singer and songwriter, John Sebastian. John Sebastian, did you have a vision of what the Lovin' Spoonful were going to sound like? Had you written Do You Believe in Magic?
I only wrote Magic after we were committed to being a band, and we were rehearsing in a basement of the Albert Hotel. Yeah. You know, the vision of the band really... One of the important factors was Eric Jacobson, who, to my mind, should be as famous as Phil Spector, but for not the same reasons.
Uh-huh.
For only some of the same reasons. Remember, he came from a kind of collegiate bluegrass group called the Noblick Upper 10,000. So he was all suffused with folk music and the kind of dawn of the pop music that might be interesting at that time. You know, people like Buddy Holly and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So having... It was the composite of of Jacobson, Yanofsky, and I and then this good effect of an excellent Long Island rhythm section that basically came out of a twist band, you know? So, and they were always the guys going, if you're going to play it at that tempo, I'll come back after you're done. They really, you know, we really had to learn quick that we weren't the coolest guys on the block in rock and roll.
they didn't approve of your tempo?
Absolutely. No, we were there to learn in that regard. We made, you know, remember, it's a band. Everybody makes, you know, not just fun of people, but like really caustic shit. Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky in that regard, because I did feel a certain amount of confidence. You know, hell, I'd been in the studio with Paul Rothschild. F*** all y'all.
After the Spoonful, you made some wonderful records, and I think one of my favorites, I'm going to say my favorite John Sebastian album, is Tarzana Kid.
Cool.
That's such a great record. Tell us a little bit about that particular record.
Well, I think a key part of that was that I was at that point really interested in getting back together with Eric Jacobson. He had had a lot to on his plate during that time. He had done, let's see, the big one was Spirit in the Sky.
Oh, yeah.
One of the biggest records.
Norman Greenbaum.
That's right. One of the biggest records of its time, you have to say. And then Chris Isaacs. And so he was, you know, in the midst of that. And Chris Isaacs, bass player, is a friend of mine. And so it was all kind of ingrown. And but then he had a moment, and I had a moment. And I was very quick to, towards the end of the Spoonful, Yanofsky was getting very impatient with Jacobson's desire to really organize things well. He wanted it to be, you know, he would have loved being in like a jam band or something if they had existed at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas, Jacobson knew full well that if you're going to stack an experience into a 2.5 minute thing, that you really have to have it really well organized.
There's no room for a 15-minute drum solo in your 45 cymbal.
Yeah. So, and they began to be confrontational with each other. So, when the band broke up, that freed me up to go back to Eric and say, look, you know, I kind of couldn't really get behind all of that, but why don't we just make a record? And he loved the idea, and we had a lot of fun and managed to work with some of my favorite folks. I mean, you know, be able to call David Grisman. I hadn't been in a band with him since 1962. And, you know, some of that stuff where Lowell and George and I were co-writing a tune, but then I was hearing these other things he was writing, going, man, this is the best.
Was that before Little Feet had formed? Or?
Well, it was Little Feet forming. Little Feet was also managed by Bob Cavallo, my manager from the Spoonful.
Talking to myself again and wondering if this traveling is good. Is there something else doing we'd be doing if we could? But all the stories we could tell. And if it all blows up and goes to hell, I can still see us sitting on a bed in some hotel, singing all the stories we could tell. Remember that guitar in a museum in Tennessee, and
nameplate on the glass brought back 20 melodies. And the scratches on the face told of all the times he fell, singing all the stories he could tell. And all the stories he could tell. And I'll bet you it still rings like a bell. And I wish that we could sit back on a bed in some hotel and listen to the stories it could tell. So if you're on the road, tracking down your every night, and singing for a living beneath the brightly colored lights, and if you ever wonder why you ride the carousel, you did it for the stories you could tell. And all the stories we could tell. And before we have to say our last farewell, well, I wish that we could sit back on a bed in some hotel and listen to the stories we could tell. Yes, I wish that we could sit back on a bed in some hotel and listen to the stories we could tell.
The Stories We Could Tell by my guest, John Sebastian, from his album, Tarzana Kid. And it's such an eclectic mix of songs on that album, Tarzana Kid.
Yeah.
Were you satisfied with the record?
I was. I was very happy with it.
Did you think it would be huge, much bigger hit, or did you not care about that?
I did. I must confess. I was, you know, my life was good. It would have been a wonderful bonus, and it was part of the stuff that you think about when you do that job. But you know, you're in pop music, you want a hit. But I must say that project had much more of an album feel, in the sense that even though it was moving around from style to style, It had a completeness about it.
I think it's the album that, you know, kind of puts the Love and Spoonful behind you, I think.
I like that.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf here on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. My guest this week is rock legend John Sebastian of the Love and Spoonful, the man responsible for this record.
And talk of all the things we did today, here, and laugh about our funny little way, while we have a few minutes to breathe, and I know that it's time you must leave, but darling, be home soon. I couldn't bear to wait an extra minute if you dawdle. My darling, be home soon. It's not just these few hours, but I've been waiting since I dawdled for the great relief of having you to talk to. And now a quarter of my life is almost past. I think I come to see myself at last. And I see that the time spent confused was the time that I spent without you. And I feel myself in blue. So darling, be home soon. Wait an extra minute if you got
my darling, be home soon. It's not just these few hours, but I've been waiting since I toddled for the great relief of having you to talk to.
The 1966 single, Darling Be Home Soon, by the Lovin' Spoonful, written and sung by my guest this week, John Sebastian. Paul Simon and U2 and Sting have recently learned that it's really difficult to, even though they're great songwriters, to write a Broadway musical. But you did that pretty early on in your career.
Well, yeah, it wasn't one that was produced or anything. We can't get too pumped up about it. But it meant a lot to me to have a guy who wanted to pay me money to come up with a musical, and it was lovely fun. I think finally I may end up putting part of it out on a children's record that I've been kind of compiling.
Let's put it on Broadway. What's going on? Let's get some backers and let's get some angels and put that thing up.
I don't know if I have the patience. I'll be frank. I really don't know. I had that experience, and it is really frustrating. I mean, I did okay with the idea of, you know, bringing six or eight people's ideas together in the form of whatever music accompanies the project. But the amount of infighting and, please, bitchiness, you know, I wasn't used to that.
Well, we were talking about being a side man, you know, that you were doing that before The Love and Spoonful, but I saw you in 1976 in Sacramento. You were playing harmonica for Fred Neil. You didn't sing. You just sat behind him and played the harmonica. So being a session, and you did those Woodstock albums that came out, I can't remember what they're called, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yes. Woodstock Mountain and Mud Acres. And,
yeah, I love those records.
So great fun.
So you continue to be a session person even after having been the star of The Love and Spoonful and of solo music.
I require it. Yes, I really do. Just to that's part of my completeness is being able to move in and out of that up in one posture.
And you still do it.
And I still do it. In fact, that call that was interrupted us, was Jules Shear
going, "Oh, really?
Hey, can we get together and do this project?" So yeah, that's the next call.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean,
yeah. So yeah, I really enjoy that kind of work. It permits me to, it's like permission to be several different characters for an actor. People know me mostly for the harmonica, but my primary instrument has always been the guitar. And playing by myself brought in the impulse to lower the instrument and make it a bigger thing that could play by itself. And I ended up having some small part in the development of the baritone guitar. And that ends up becoming a kind of a studio specialty, because it's a great addendum for a guitar record where you still want it to be the same essential sound, but in that lower register really helps.
What's a record that we could hear that has your guitar, your lower guitar on there?
Let's see. Boy, it's quite a lot of it on a semi unheard of record called Tar Beach. And Tar Beach, I was using the baritone probably half the time making that record.
Song by my guest, John Sebastian, utilizing his baritone guitar.
So yeah, not on. It's not a like a top 10 record I can point you to.
But, and that one you're about to record with Jules Shearer, that's going to be up there. That's going to be a number one.
Well, that's a call for, that's a harmonica call. and so, but that's how it always starts. I just put other things in the car, and then when we get there and we go, gee, what would sound good here? And I go, well, you know, Joe Vayette made this little octave 12 string. It's a little teeny thing that's, you know, it sounds like a 12 string that shrunk. And we end up using that. Or the baritone is the other culprit that always people always jump to. So I love the variety. I love being able to... it's like freedom to paint any color you want.
And you live in Woodstock. Is it still a music community? Everybody there plays music together?
You know, I think during your telephone call is the best evidence I can show. Yeah, and I mean, you never know.
There he is again.
Oh, my God.
Well, John Sebastian, it's really been an honor having you on the show. Thank you so much for talking with us today on From the Bookshelf.
All right. Well, be well, and thanks to you and your listeners.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and will come back and see me again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, legendary rock star, John Sebastian. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.